In this episode, recorded during the fourth gathering of the Parlamerica's Open Parliament Network, Beyond the Walls of Parliament, Strengthening Parliamentary Oversight, Ms. Shaska Bayerly, Senior Research Advisor, Program on Nonviolent Action of the United States Institute of Peace, delivers a keynote speech focused on the role of citizens in combating corruption and its active participation and engagement as a way to contribute to these efforts.
It's an honor to be here today, and I would like to thank the Asamblea Nacional and Parlamericas for the opportunity to be a part of your important gathering. So, our session is focused on developing a systemic approach to countering corruption and improving governance in the Americas. And I'm lucky to follow Juan Ricardo Ortega, who gave you an excellent overview from an economic standpoint, from a political standpoint. And what I would like to do is complement that and talk about a force for change to impact corruption that can be a synergistic force with the force that comes from members of parliament who are seeking to impact corruption in their countries. Hence the title, Citizen Participation and Action to Combat Corruption. And I just wanted to give you an idea of what is happening around the world. And in fact, I could have many, many slides to document where citizens are mobilizing, in part because of corruption and in part because they want to impact corruption and improve governance. I'm not going to go over any of these countries, but it gives you an idea that this is happening around the world, including in our region of the Americas. The one academic point I would like to make is about corruption. Because we are thinking about a systemic approach, it's very important to define corruption in a way that captures how it functions in systems. And that's why how we define this problem will impact how we will address it. So the one definition I would like to give you is the following. We have the traditional definition that is used widely, for example, by Transparency International. But this definition suggests an interaction between two parties. But because we in this room understand that we need a systemic approach, we need a systemic definition of corruption. And so I offer to you this second definition, which is derived from Transparency International, but is expanded. So it is about the abuse of entrusted power, not only for private gain, but for collective gain of a group in society or for political gain. And that's very important because corruption affects all sectors potentially in a given society. And it involves relationships. And these relationships are complex. And most of them we don't know. They are below the surface. They are hidden. And those relationships are built on vested interests. Because those vested interests are benefiting from corruption. So when we think about impacting corruption, that means we are threatening the vested interests of all those people in those relationships who are benefiting. And that's why it's so difficult to impact it. And that's why it can be dangerous for people when they try to impact it. And they can be killed even when they try. And those vested interests cut across different sectors of society, as we heard in the previous session. It can be between, for example, government and private sector. It's across countries, as the Honorable Chacon talked about. So it's not about corruption within one institution or one entity. This corruption is connected. Again, that makes our struggle difficult. But that doesn't mean it's impossible to impact. I was asked to talk a little bit about the linkages between corruption and other problems in our society, in our societies from where we come from. And one is violent conflict. And some of us have experienced this firsthand. There is an intimate linkage between corruption and violent conflict. And I'm just giving you a few quotes here or a few bits of information from different reports. But where you find that the corruption controls, rule of law, government effectiveness are weak, which I think we heard already, you have a 30 to 45% higher risk of civil war in your country. And if you look at checklists to look for early warning indicators before a violent conflict erupts, again, we see elements of corruption as an indicator of a possibility for violent conflict to erupt. And as many of us know in this room also, corruption can enable and draw out violent conflicts. Because those groups that are involved in the conflict have to engage in illicit activities to function. There's no way that they can function without engaging in illicit activities that involve corruption. They need it to get weapons, to move across borders, they need it to get supplies, and they need it to get recruits. So it's intimately linked to enabling and drawing out conflicts. And it also inhibits peace building. So when a country comes out of a violent conflict, that system of corruption that existed during the conflict doesn't vanish. It's still there. And that can enable state capture, as we heard, by organized crime. And it allows the entrenchment of often, not always, but often, the entrenchment of key actors in the conflict into the new government and state institutions. And we also heard that corruption is linked to poverty. And one can find all kinds of documents that talk about this. And again, corruption is undermining rule of law, democracy, it slows economic development, as we heard, and it enables organized crime and terrorism. So what does this mean? It means that corruption is linked to all the major challenges that we face within our borders and oftentimes transnationally across borders. And so the concept that I'd like to pass to you is this concept of intersectionality. I don't know how that translates into French and Spanish. But all these problems are linked. So while sometimes we need to tackle a problem independently, oftentimes when we are tackling a problem, we are tackling all the problems at once. Or by trying to improve one aspect of a major problem in our society, we are improving other aspects in the society. And so I thought that this quote from our new United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, really encapsulated the intersectionality of these challenges that we face in our societies. A lot of you are interested in rule of law, so I wanted to just give you a sense of what rule of law involves. And so I thought that this would be very interesting. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the World Justice Rule of Law Index. The 2019 index was just published. It's about how the general public experiences and perceives elements of rule of law in their countries. The research took place in 126 countries. 120,000 households were surveyed, and that involved 3,800 expert surveys. So if you look at the different elements, again, you see this intersectionality. Rule of law involves anti-corruption, it involves fundamental rights, it involves open governments. So again, this sense that all of these elements are linked for a functioning democratic society in which citizens have rights and opportunities. So they fortunately actually gave some statistics that looked at Latin America and Caribbean. So I thought that some of you would find this interesting. It's not meant to be a beauty contest where who's better and who isn't. I think this is meant to just help us see that we can look at this information and see what households in many of our countries are thinking about rule of law. And what's really important is that most countries are failing to provide meaningful opportunities for the public. So there's another interesting survey that comes out every year called the Open Budget Survey. And this too will be very relevant to Parlamerica's participants because it looks at evaluates the opportunities governments are giving to civil society and the public to engage in decisions about how public resources are raised and spent. And again, you might find this table interesting. By the way, this PowerPoint will be available on the Parlamerica's website in both languages, so you can look this up later if you're interested for the resources. What's really interesting about this survey is that it finds that most countries are failing to provide meaningful opportunities for the public to participate in the budget process. And not a single country in the survey had what they considered participation opportunities that are considered adequate. Not one country in the survey. So there are no stars in this survey. And what that means is that we all have room to improve. Now we get to the other part, which is interesting, the role of citizens and why this makes a difference for the legislative branch, for legislators and parliaments. The corruption barometer is not conducted every year, but the most recent results in 2017 really struck me. A large majority of citizens said that they were hopeful about the positive role citizens could play in tackling graft. 7 in 10, 70% agreed that ordinary people could make a difference. And to me, what this means is that we are not hitting a wall. Citizens in general, in the countries surveyed by the Corruption Perceptions Barometer, want to make a difference. So the question is not, do citizens want to make a difference? The question is, how can they make a difference? And how can they synergize their activities with those within parliaments who also want to make a difference? Many of you are familiar with the United Nations Convention Against Corruption. And again, what is striking is how now there is a new current globally, a recognition that citizens and civil society have an essential role to play. And if we think that we can put this together, citizen interest with legislative interest and interest within governments, we are on a wave that is going up. We are not on the wave going down. We are going up. And again, what's striking is the United Nations Convention Against Corruption says that each party should promote the active participation of individuals and groups. They didn't say participation. They said active participation. And this is the essence of what citizens can do to impact corruption. Citizens can actively take initiative. They can be protagonists. They can be initiators. And they can be drivers in an anti-corruption agenda. So you may be thinking, this sounds really nice. Oh, it sounds like a beautiful story, but where's the reality? Does this really happen? So I want to just share with you a little bit. And again, this is just giving you a flavor. It's not giving you the in-depth information. But if you look at the track record of organized citizen nonviolent action, it is amazing the impact that it can have. Take the most difficult cases of campaigns to impact authoritarian governments and external occupations. This was a huge research project that looked at every single case from 1900 to 2006. And they compared nonviolent and violent campaigns. They wanted to look at the efficacy of nonviolent campaigns versus violent campaigns. And they found that major nonviolent campaigns have achieved success 53% of the time, compared with 26% of the time for violent campaigns.
Okay.
That's just a nice graph to tell you the same thing. But it also looks at failures, and it looks at limited success. So again, it's interesting to dig into this research. Then they found some other interesting results. If they looked at democratic governance 5 years afterwards, they looked at the probability a country would be a democracy 5 years after the end of a campaign, violent or nonviolent. And you can see the difference. It's astounding. Successful nonviolent campaigns had a 6% probability of democratic governance 5 years later, compared to successful nonviolent campaigns. Now, this doesn't mean there are always happy endings. As you can see, 43% of the nonviolent campaigns did not have a democratic governance after 5 years. But when you compare it to the violent campaigns, there's still a huge difference. And again, if we get back to violent conflict, it's really interesting. This research found that the probability of experiencing a civil war within 10 years after the conflict was 43% when there was a violent campaign. So almost close to 50%. Whereas with nonviolent campaigns, the probability of a civil war 10 years later was 28%. Again, astounding differences. So for what we are thinking about today, what we are talking about today, I'd like to give you a sense that we are talking about proactive citizen participation. Parlamericas has taken the lead in looking at ways to engage citizens and ways to support citizen participation. And I read through this entire toolkit and was really, really, it's an exceptional document and exceptional ideas and roadmap for legislators to think about what they can do in their own countries. So what I'd like to suggest is that when we talk about proactive citizen engagement, we think of constructive engagement with parliaments and governments and organized nonviolent action. And organized nonviolent action can take the form of monitoring budgets, monitoring projects, monitoring public procurement. It can be vigils, it can be sometimes protests, it can be sometimes boycotts. So it's this combination that can be very effective. So it involves organizing citizens, mobilizing them, engaging in nonviolent action, disrupting systems of corruption, and constructive engagement and dialogue with power holders, from parliaments, for example, or from governments, or other power holders in society. And when we talk about proactive citizen engagement, we mean regular people exerting power who are the protagonists to curb corruption, increase transparency, gain accountability, improve governance, and all these linked challenges in our societies. And what struck me also when I was reading through this document and other documents from Parlamericas is this term co-creation. It's not on the slide, but I think this is where the synergy can also come. This concept of co-creation between legislative bodies and other actors and sectors in society, which includes citizens and civil society. And what struck me also is co-creators implies a relationship of equals. It doesn't imply a power imbalance where one is more powerful or better than the other. It implies that both parties are important and have a role and can work together and set the agenda together. So proactive citizen engagement. Why do citizens add a strategic advantage? Again, it's not, we don't want to think about citizens just because it's nice. They bring something to the table that legislators and members of and government officials cannot bring. They add extra institutional pressure. For those of you in institutions, you can try hard. You can set the agenda. You can develop political will, but you can still be blocked by all those corrupt vested interests that are going to try to prevent you from threatening their benefits and gains. So you need this added extra institutional pressure. It's an added part of the equation. So top-down, elite-driven, and bottom-up approaches can be complementary. So there are four lessons, and I'm going to be really quick. I'm going to go through this very quickly. First, that citizens that are organized in these grassroots movements, campaigns, community efforts can achieve real outcomes. I won't go through them, but you will see many of these cases are relevant to what you do as legislators. And again, you can look through all these links and this in the PowerPoint if you wish. Top-down and bottom-up can be complementary. And I think for our meeting today, this is a really important thing to just talk about a little bit more. Active citizen participation can be an ally to what legislators are doing. I'm not saying it always happens, and sometimes they can be very critical of parliaments and legislators, but sometimes they can be allies in what you do. And one very good example comes from the Accountability Lab. Those who are fighting corruption on the inside need the support of citizens because, again, because there are too many vested interests that are going to try to block your efforts. You need the power of numbers of citizens to be there for solidarity, protection, and to just create a climate in society or in the institution that says it's okay not to go along with corruption, even if others are going along with corruption. Citizen efforts can create political will, and they can maintain the political will. As we heard in the previous presentation, it's not enough to get a legislation passed or a mechanism. That's essential, but then you need the implementation. And again, there are cases where citizens have played a very important role. And ultimately, it's about changing, in the long run, it's about changing behaviors and practices and norms. Because as we heard, you can't put everybody in jail. It's not just about sanctions. It's also about rewarding honest behavior and integrity. We need to balance the negative and the positive. We find citizen movements and campaigns all over the world in the most difficult contexts. And one thing that's very important is that citizens are not going to stand up and put their time and efforts and take risks for something that's abstract. They need to see how this is linked, or they will make the linkages for those in power to understand why it's important to fight corruption, not just at the abstract level, but how it affects people in their lives. Finally, recommendations. Anna, and I have, 30 seconds? So I think for recommendations, it's the combination that can be very powerful and a new way to think about this synergy between citizens and parliaments and others in power. Information plus active citizen participation can lead to outcomes. I'm not saying always, but can. Citizens can be your eyes and ears, and this is really important. They can help identify corruption and problems. If you see them mobilizing, that means it's a signal that something is wrong. And And that can help you to determine where you should shine your light and where you should tackle things and what you should address. And linking anti-corruption and transparency efforts to their problems. One way is through formal citizen participation efforts. And I think, again, this is outlined in this very good toolkit. And another way is through less formal mechanisms. And I will skip down again to the very end, co-creating citizen-friendly procedures and mechanisms. So it's not enough to have a law or a mechanism. If that law or mechanism is not citizen-friendly, it's not going to harness the power of citizens. Take a Right to Information Act or a Freedom of Information Act. Some are good, some are impossible to use. Take budget, take procurement or public budget inquiries. Some are easy in which to involve citizens, and some are very difficult. So again, thinking about how the legislation is designed and how the mechanisms are designed is very important. I'll stop there. Thank you for your attention.